Thank you very much for that kind welcome. I will do my best to speak loudly. I am known for being soft-spoken and spending a lot of time behind my desk with spreadsheets. So I get up in front of people occasionally, but do very much enjoy the chance to be here with you. So Doug, I think, gave a pretty good overview of why I'm here and what I want to talk about. So I'm just going to go ahead and jump right in. I like to start my talks with a question, which is, how many of you have a smartphone? And just go ahead and raise your hand. You can see they're pretty ubiquitous. Hold on to that idea that you and most of the folks around you have one. It's going to be important as we go through this conversation. So you have a smartphone. One of the things I think is really interesting to think about with that smartphone is many of today's high school students have never used anything but a smartphone or like a landline phone. Many of today's elementary students or young children like mine think that every phone that we have can take pictures, play movies, and send messages from everywhere. They have no idea where we've come from. And I think the important point about that is that these disruptive devices have put unprecedented power in the hands of just about everybody, and in a very short period of time. So let's go back to the phone for a second. Raise your hand again if you have a smartphone. Thank you for doing that. And then keep your hand up if that phone came from your landline phone company. There's a surprising lack of hands in the air. There's a few. I appreciate the folks who do that. It always surprises me. And the idea is that there's a lot of disruption happening that has happened in our communications industry. And the point is that most of that disruption is coming from the outside. And that same kind of disruption, whether it's smartphones or solar or energy storage or electric vehicles, is rapidly changing the way that we get our electricity. And of course, just like with smartphones and mobile phones and telecommunications, it's a change that ought to feel familiar. The threat of mobile phones to landline phone companies, after all, is being mirrored in the energy business. And in much the same way, people talk about cord cutters in the phone industry, people who no longer have landline phones. And as I'm going to talk about later, that's going to become more and more real for our electric companies, is that people will have the potential to be cord cutters. So it has big implications. It has big implications for the monopoly companies that control our electric grid, but also for our chance to change who's in charge of that grid. So I think it's always useful to give a little bit of history about how the electricity system has operated so that people can understand just how innovative and dynamic and different today's era is. So utilities have been very staid and secure. They have relied for decades on burning fossil fuels or splitting atoms to generate heat, to boil water, to generate steam, to move that along to steam turbines, losing a fair amount of it along the way, to turn those turbines to generate electricity. And in almost every case, being bigger meant being more efficient. And so those power plants steadily got larger and larger, some of them generating enough power for hundreds of thousands of homes. And the result was a good thing. It was lower prices for electricity decade after decade from the early 1900s through the 1960s. And, you know, there were a few offshoots of, you know, or issues with air pollution or radioactive waste, but we didn't seem to care too much about those at the time. The largely ignored cost of this centralization, though, and this focus on economies of scale and bigger is better, was the concentration of our utility companies into monopolies, much like the landline phone business. And, you know, actually the granting of these monopolies was deliberate. Samuel Insull, who's pictured here, was a protege of Thomas Edison, and it was he, along with progressive era politicians in the early 1900s, that first created this regulatory compact where these big companies would be given a publicly sanctioned monopoly in order to have have that protection from competition in exchange for delivering power at lower prices. And Wisconsin was actually one of the first to do this. Back in 1905, they were close on the heels of New York in forming one of the first state utility commissions to oversee these new formed monopolies. Wisconsin was one of the first, and one might argue that it is still paying the price. So a secondary cost of this reliance on the bigger is better mantra, on centralizing the capital needed to build these big power plants, was the slowing of technological innovation. And the reason that I've shown a picture of cake is that if you're a baker and you want to make a better cake, you're going to try your recipe and you're going to try different things. You're going to change the level of the ingredients. You might change how long you bake it for. But the idea is that the more you try it, the closer you're going to get to the perfect recipe. And in recent years, electricity demand has stagnated, but not only that, the larger and larger our power plants get, the fewer we need to build in order to meet our demand. In other words, we've slowed even the incremental improvement in our existing fossil fuel or nuclear power generation technology. And not only that, as the iteration and learning has slowed in the technologies of power generation, a culture of stagnation has set in that's also reinforced by a lack of competition. So this is an anecdote I had. I was giving a talk in Tucson, Arizona a couple of years ago, and unbeknownst to me in the audience was a representative of Tucson Electric Power, and he was given the floor after I spoke to respond to some of the points that I had made about the cost effectiveness of distributed renewable energy. He didn't end up actually doing that, but what he did say was that the culture of the utility was not to be the innovator, to do the interesting things, to take advantage of the disruptive and new technologies, that what they came to work to do each day was what they did the day before. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind here, is that it's not that utilities don't necessarily want an opportunity to do something different. It is that they may have a culture that is incompatible with doing something different. So let's talk a little bit about what a different era we are in today in terms of an electricity system from that time when simply building bigger power plants to meet ever-increasing demand was able to bring in the return of lower-cost energy. For one, we're able to use things like smiley faces on our electric bills to incent people to reduce their demand. We're seeing as much as 1-3% reduction in energy consumption just by giving people a comparison to their neighbors, by using smiley faces or frowny faces to tell them whether or not they are, in fact, an efficient user of electricity. We're using old technologies like radio control combined with air conditioners to reduce power demand on peak energy use days. Northern States Power, or Xcel Energy of Minnesota, has successfully networked enough residential air conditioners to save 330 megawatts of demand, equal to a medium-sized gas power plant. So these kinds of technological, or these kinds of changes in the system, are fundamentally changing the way that utilities have operated for decades. And it's also changing the entire nature of the system that has been, as always, about energy growth. So I'm going to go for a question here. You get a little quiz, which is, when did electricity sales peak nationwide? And I'll run through each of these, and you can just raise your hand for whichever one you think it is. So was it in 2013 was the last time that we saw electricity sales growth? Or at 2010? It's a smart energy crowd. 2007. And then 2005. And how many for earlier than that? The answer is it was in 2007. So it's been almost a decade since nationally we've seen any growth in electricity sales. And this is unprecedented. Electricity demand was growing by 10% per year back in the 1950s and 60s. And it started to slow in the 70s and has come to a complete standstill after the so-called big recession. So we're fundamentally changing the nature of the electricity business already just in terms of reducing the amount that we're consuming. We're also changing the nature of how we produce energy. So another question for you. When is the last year that fossil fuel technologies provided more than 60% of new power plant capacity? So we build new power plants every year. We have to replace old ones that are now defunct. Sometimes we're building to meet new peak energy needs. Sometimes we're doing it in compliance with energy laws. So when is the last year that fossil fuels provided more than 60% of new capacity? And you have the same choices as you had in the last one. 2013, anybody? 2010? 2007? 2005? How many think it was earlier than 2005? It is a renewable energy crowd, of course. You know, the answer is 2005. I'm still amazed by this, that in the last decade, the majority of our new power plant capacity is coming from renewable energy. But I'm even more amazed and heartened by the fact that a significant portion of that is coming from distributed energy sources. So the boxes highlighted there, the red boxes that are highlighted in the white squares, represent distributed solar's share of new power plant capacity in each of the last 10 to 12 years. And it's been growing. In the past few years, it's been between 10 and 15%. In the first quarter of 2016, it was almost 30%, coming from essentially rooftops on residential and commercial buildings. That is a huge change from the way that we have traditionally gotten our electricity, but it's also a huge change from where we're getting our electricity. The stuff that's in those boxes is not coming from utility companies. And the other thing that this is doing, so we not only have stagnant sales, we not only have power coming from different places than it's ever come before, but it's putting cost pressures on the utilities who have traditionally overbuilt in anticipation of growing demand, and then sold that electricity on the wholesale market in other, to other places. You would think that if all of them are trying to do the same thing, it wouldn't be very effective. But it's particularly not effective now that we have a lot of wind power on the system, which has no fuel cost to operate. And so wind is setting the wholesale price for our energy systems, and it means utilities are no longer able to sell their excess energy from their fossil fuel or nuclear power plants. So it's very much changing the game for the utility companies. So we have utilities that are sort of culturally stagnant and technology that for them has not changed very much. And we have a system now that's moving much, much faster than they've ever seen before. And I'm going to give you a few examples. First of all, solar. In 2014, it was every 150 seconds that we installed a new solar array in the United States. Now it's about every 60 seconds. That's about 10 of them since I started, although I'm not entirely sure because sometimes I go faster when I'm up in front of people. But the thing that's so amazing about solar is that it's mass-produced. So the same panels that you might see here at the Energy Fair are the same ones that the utilities are going to use in their big utility-scale fields. And what that's meant is that the manufacturing has rapidly driven down the cost of solar. We're having rapid innovation not only in that manufacturing, but also in the delivery and installation of solar, because we're driving so many new installations, driving so much new production. And of course, that's rapidly driving down the cost. Many of you are probably familiar with a chart like this showing in the bars the rising installed capacity of solar in this country, and in the green line, the rapidly falling cost. And I think the most exciting thing about solar is not only is it getting competitive with retail electricity prices, which is where solar on our rooftops competes with, is at the retail level, but it is going to be increasingly competitive. And over the next decade, solar is likely to be competitive in just about every state without any subsidies. It's not just solar, though, that's getting cheaper quickly. It's energy storage. We're using batteries in all sorts of things, laptops, smartphones, watches, electric vehicles. And the more and more that we build of them, the cheaper they're going to get. I'm sure some of you have heard of Elon Musk's Tesla company and his Gigafactory in Nevada, which is slated to almost double worldwide production of battery technology. It's going to result in significantly cheaper energy storage. And it's not just that the new technologies are getting cheaper, they're also getting smarter. This is actually a picture on the left there of my home thermostat. If I wanted right now, I could say, you know, the kids could probably manage it a couple degrees warmer. They can always go play in the sprinkler. It's amazing that we can do that. I mean, actually, technically, I don't think I have an internet connection here. So we have one last hurdle to overcome in that. But the point is that we have unprecedented control over our energy use, whether it's the home thermostat or the smartphone, whether it's lighting control. We have a new expectation of control. Frankly, once people have opportunities to have control, they're not going to want to give it up. And it's not just that we have these technologies available now, but they continue to change and improve year after year. With software updates, we can improve the thermostat and the phone to take on new tasks. And even the phone itself. My phone will last, you know, 3 to 5 years before the battery is completely defunct or before the technology no longer works effectively, but they release a new model every year and new software, and the apps that go on my phone update maybe every week or every month. So the hardware and the software of our communications technology and our power generation technology is changing very fast. It's a whole new world for electric companies. And the point is that the energy market has already started to change, and I have a couple of stories about that. One of them is a small town of Minster, Ohio, population 3,000. It's got a municipal utility, and they set out to build some solar. There was a renewable energy law in Ohio, as there is in most states. And then something happened. Some monopoly utility companies thought that we shouldn't have a renewable energy law anymore, and they got the politicians to agree to pause, as they call it, that renewable energy law. And it meant that this town's plans for a solar array were in jeopardy because they weren't sure that they could make the economics of it work. And then a developer came to them and said, why don't you put a battery on it? And I'm sure at first they were confused because they thought batteries are expensive. There's no way that this could work. But as it turns out, solar with a battery means that they can more easily manage, as a utility company, the purchases of energy from the wholesale market, which means that when energy is really expensive, they don't have to buy it because they can use the battery and the solar to avoid that. And second of all, that a battery, in some markets anyway, at least in Ohio, can be used to sell services to the greater grid, regulating voltage and frequency, some of the things that are sort of generically called power quality, and that batteries happen to be just about the best technology available. So it means that not only was the town able to build its solar array, which now provides about 10% of their electricity on an annual basis, but they're able to sell those services to the greater grid to manage their peak energy purchases. In other words, they're making money. by doing this, and no thanks to the monopoly utility companies. Another state is talked about a lot in the way that the market is changing. People talk about a postcard from the energy future in Hawaii, where 15% of households have already installed solar because it was cheaper for them than buying all that energy from the electric utility. Now, the utilities weren't too pleased about this, and recently they were successful at pushing the Utilities Commission to end net metering, to end the bill credit mechanism that allowed most of these people to affordably pay back their investment in solar. And yet again, the market responded with SolarCity saying, we'll sell you not only a solar panel, but a battery to go with it. And so you are now going to be able to get electricity from the sun and your battery and still beat the grid prices of the monopoly utility company. And the point here is that Hawaii is not an outlier in this, that in the next decade or two, this opportunity, this economic opportunity, is going to be available everywhere. The Rocky Mountain Institute, in fact, has put out a study essentially saying that the combination of rapidly getting cheaper solar and rapidly getting cheaper batteries is going to mean that within 20 years, in just about every state in the United States, homeowners or business owners are going to be able to get cheaper electricity from their rooftop than from the electric utility. And that economic choice is fundamentally eroding the utility's political power. So ultimately what that means is that the technology and these disruptive forces, from smartphones to solar to batteries, are eroding the utility's political power. And that the electric system looks less like a monopoly than at any time since Samuel Insull first suggested that utilities should accept public regulation in exchange for government protection from competition. So it's a big opportunity. And I want to talk a little bit about what that big opportunity is. First of all, it's an opportunity to tap into the $360 billion a year in electricity sales in this country. In some ways, it's all up for grabs, and local communities can stand to benefit. And I want to give you another sense of how big that opportunity is. By the way, this is apparently a picture of what it would look like to stack $1 billion bills. So $360 billion would take 360 of these, and I couldn't figure out a way to make the clip art work. But another way to picture this opportunity is not just the money, but in terms of what the opportunity is in terms of electricity generation in our local communities. So what this is this is a map that was produced by the National Renewable Energy Labs. They just updated this data earlier this year that looks at the percentage of a state's annual electricity use that could be met by rooftop solar alone. So on residential, commercial roofs, public buildings, what have you. And you can look at Wisconsin here, which is 40%, and I just want to sit on that for a second. 40% of the electricity that we use on an annual basis could come from rooftops alone. That's not counting parking lots where we could put solar, brownfields, landfills, solar anywhere else that you can think of. That's an enormous amount that we can do at a local level, right where we use electricity, at minimal transmission costs. And what that means is that the second thing is that the issue, technology is also going to solve this issue about backup or standby or spillover onto the larger grid. Because while when you have solar alone on a home, about 50% of that electricity is actually captured in the home. Because a lot of times the homeowner's not there, they're not using the energy during the daytime when the solar array is producing. It goes back onto the grid. Every study, by the way, says that that's of a benefit to the greater grid, but we'll get into that a little bit later. But the point is that when you combine it with some of these other smart technologies, whether it's electric vehicles or batteries or the smart thermostats and smartphones, almost 90% of that electricity can actually be captured on site. So we not only have an opportunity to generate an enormous amount of our energy locally, but to use it locally as well. And there are, of course, big benefits for that, and I'm going to run through a few of them. The first one, of course, is just renewable energy is a big benefit. Fossil fuel pollution costs Minnesota, for example, $2.1 billion a year in health and environmental costs, mostly from coal-fired generation. But not only that, renewable energy is a great hedge against volatile fuel prices. We've all heard about fracking and natural gas is super cheap, and electric companies, believe me, love building natural gas plants right now because the forecast looks splendid when you use really low prices that we've had for just the past few years. But I want to point out that although the line for natural gas there in gray is pretty low on the right side, the line on the bottom, which you might mistake for the x-axis, is the cost to get fuel for solar and wind, and it's always zero. I should point out two things about that. One is that that risk of the cost of fuel is always borne by the electric customer. It is a pass-through from the electric company. So of course they don't care what the price is right now. All they have to do is be able to squeak that past the utility commission. The second thing about why this is important, though, is that this is when we are making good policy to encourage distributed generation, like the value of solar rule that we got in Minnesota. Hedging on the fuel costs for natural gas was a key component of that and one of the biggest elements of savings that solar can promise to the grid. Because if you go out and you try on the open market to get a contract for natural gas for 25 years, you simply can't get one. No one's willing to guarantee the price that long. So renewable energy has a lot of benefits, which I'm sure everyone is aware of. Distributed energy has particular benefits as well. When we talk about utilities saying that, oh, solar is going to have all these integration costs and complications for us to integrate to the grid, that might be true if you were talking about all the solar built in one specific place where one cloud could cover it up. But if we disperse solar generation over a wide area, it reduces by tenfold those integration costs. We also have local economic benefits. When you build a megawatt of solar, based on a 2014 analysis we did with National Renewable Energy Lab, it's JEDI tool for economic analysis, it's about $2.5 million in economic impact and about 20 jobs that are created. But more important than that is the $5.5 million in energy savings that that 1 megawatt of solar is going to deliver over its lifetime. And that's money that comes right into the local economy. And that's why distributed solar has so much more value for our communities than simply solar built anywhere and by anybody. Randy Cavanis can tell you all about it. He was part of a group called the Green Energy Farmers in Iowa that in around 2010 decided that they would try to build some community wind farms, could sell electricity to the local rural electric cooperatives, and give a lot of farmers in that area a chance to invest in renewable energy. And been very successful. You can read more about it in a recent report that we did on community-owned renewable energy. But one of the things that Randy understood better than any utility executive, I think, is that community ownership meant bigger economic gains for his community. And of course, those economic gains hold up in many different ways. Local ownership tends to have more jobs created for the same size project, a significant greater economic impact. And then I want to dwell a little bit on this last thing, which is a little bit hard to understand without some explanation. But some researchers in Germany were admiring the way that they were rapidly expanding renewable energy. And they were thinking to themselves, what's the implication of the choice that we've made to let average and ordinary people invest in solar and wind in a way that hasn't been done in a lot of other places? So they thought, well, let's study this. Let's find a couple of different towns, one that has locally owned renewable energy projects and the other one that doesn't. And let's see if that makes a difference in the attitudes that people have toward renewable energy. And what they found was remarkable. It was as much as a 40 to 50 point difference in support for adding additional renewable energy in that nearby region if folks had had a chance to be part owners of that, if they had skin in the game, if they could make some money from it. And I think that's one of the key, every time folks talk to me about climate change, which incidentally is not something that we focus a lot on at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, I tell them the way that we're going to be successful in addressing climate change or renewables or any of those things is to give people a chance to participate and benefit themselves, and that will motivate them much better than any kind of moral imperative that we can give them. It helps to have a moral imperative too, don't get me wrong. So what's holding us back? We have all of this disruptive technology, we have utilities that are on their heels in responding to it. And the problem, of course, is that we have antique rules for the utility system. So as I mentioned, you know, the utility companies that have for years and years benefited from building ever larger power plants to address growing electricity demand, and they're still stuck in that model. And it's holding the public interest captive. Frankly, you should know all about this, at least if you're from Wisconsin, because monopoly protection fees, as I like to call them, are shifting more of the energy bill toward what we call fixed charges. So there's two parts to your electric bill. There's the part you get charged every month just for being a customer, and there's the part you pay based on how much energy you use. And traditionally, the part that's based on how much energy you use is the larger part of the bill. And that gives us all sorts of great incentives to reduce energy consumption, which isn't just an environmental benefit, but an economic benefit, not just for that user, but for the whole system. Because the utilities build that system to meet peak energy demand, and the more we can reduce that demand, the more cost-effectively we can produce energy for everyone. But now what Wisconsin Utilities and what frankly many others are doing is saying, let's actually move more of the stuff over here. Because what we're noticing is that people are actually taking advantage of the way the bill is structured and saving money. And even though that's definitely in the public interest, it is not in their private interest. And so they are shifting more of the bill to be at that fixed portion. And that means not only have we got the wrong incentives for the way that we use energy, but we also have low-income ratepayers, folks on fixed incomes who no longer have any ability to control their energy consumption and energy use. So the good news is that although we know the rules of the system are antique, we also already know that new rules can kickstart the next stage of innovation because they already have. So here's a question for you. This is a smart audience, I can tell, because you answered the questions before so well. So what are some of the policies that we've already had that have shifted our utility system toward the things that we want to see, the things that we have in our public interest, whether that's clean energy or energy efficiency? What are the policies that we've had? Go ahead and shout them out. Investment tax credit, yep. Net metering. Renewable energy standards.
Feed-in tariffs.
Energy efficiency standards. All of these things. And I'll go through each one here. Net metering, 41 states. And the District of Columbia still have net metering laws that give you a bill credit for reducing your energy consumption. These have been around since the mid-1980s and have given a whole bunch of incentive to people to shift toward generating their own energy. And now that it is, of course, now that it's becoming more cost-effective, the utility companies don't like it so much. But at any rate, it's a policy that has been very successful at shifting the way that we look at this. We have renewable energy standards in about 30 states that have required utility companies to align their interest in the public interest by building renewables, and generally speaking, doing it for much cheaper than they thought they could. And you can see here that, of course, we had a rush toward renewable energy standards in the 2000s. We have energy efficiency standards pointing out to utilities that the cheapest kilowatt hour we can get is the one that we don't use. And again, a very popular idea in the 2000s, pushing a lot of utilities to find more cost-effective energy. And of course, we've also had policies specifically targeting solar and other distributed renewable energy resources, because we've recognized that all utilities that and state legislators have recognized that even though utilities have retained legal monopolies on power supply, they no longer have a technological monopoly on power generation. So what we really need are some new rules. We have these rules and we have used these rules, but part of the problem with these rules is that every time we've wanted to pass them or defend them, we are fighting the same political and economic monopolies as we've had before. So what are the rules that we need for the 21st century grid system, and how can we design those rules in a way that will start to undermine the political opposition that we face every single time we want to do something in the public interest? One of those things is what I like to call the grid as a commons. I apologize for the crappy clip art, but it's pretty hard to find a good image of this, unfortunately. And the grid as a commons concept is something that we ought to be familiar with. We use it in a couple of different ways. For the internet, for example, in fact, there was just a court case, a court decision in this past week that upheld the idea that the internet or net neutrality should be upheld and that everybody should have free and undiscriminatory access to the internet. I wish it was free, actually. I mean, the people who I pay to get my internet access are certainly not free. But we also have a road network that can be used by all sorts of different companies, whether that's FedEx or UPS or DHL or the US Postal Service. And the road network is paid for by everybody and offers undiscriminatory access for everyone. And how can a commons like this help? Well, for example, if we have Consolidated Edison, which is the investor-owned utility serving New York City and much of the rest of that area of New York State, they recently went to the Public Service Commission in the past year or two and said, we got to upgrade the substation serving New York City. It's going to cost $1 billion in order to meet the growth in peak energy demand. And the Regulatory Commission in New York, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about in a minute, has been going through this process of evaluating this grid as a commons concept. And what they said to Con Ed was, we actually want you to go out in the market and see if you can find a cheaper way to meet that same demand. That we need to take advantage of the fact that lots of people can bring resources to bear on the grid. And so they did. They put out a request for proposal and they found distributed resources in terms of demand response and energy efficiency and conservation that were able to deliver the same power capacity as a $1 billion substation upgrade for 1/5 the price. So there is a huge opportunity to find different ways of meeting the same needs for the electricity system if we're willing to look outside the traditional participants. The second thing is that we need to figure out how to shift from central planning to what some folks call transparent pricing, or hourly pricing, or time of use pricing. But the idea here is that why don't we reward customers that use solar or storage or distributed or demand reduction in service of a more efficient electric grid? The entire utility system for 100 years had been built for that 1 5-minute time period in August on a hot summer sunny afternoon when everybody's running their air conditioners. And about 30% of the capacity that we built that for, or maybe 40%, doesn't ever do anything. It's just waiting for that 5 minutes. We can do a lot better than that. And one of the ways that we can do this is with hourly pricing. There was a voluntary pilot done by the Pennsylvania Electric Company, now a subsidiary of Exelon, but they were able to get 6% peak energy reduction during the 2 to 6 p.m. peak period by simply allowing people to voluntarily opt in to their time of use pilot. It's kind of one of those boring and technical things, but when we think about the way that we can enable this with smartphones and smart thermostats so that it can be something that people can sign up for and it can be managed automatically, why shouldn't we be doing this? So the third thing in terms of the new rules that we need a grid as a commons, we need transparent pricing that allows participation, but we also need that $360 billion opportunity to be accessible to everybody, and not just those with a prime credit score. One of the tools that we can use for this is called on-bill repayment. The idea behind it is that if I want to finance insulation or a new hot water heater or a solar hot water facility on my house, or maybe subscribe to community solar garden, that I would simply sign up with it through the provider of that service, and that cost of that would be financed over, say, 5 to 10 or 12 years on my utility bill. So I would be able to not only see the savings, but the cost in the same place. And generally speaking, most of the programs are run and designed in a way that allows people to have a small amount of energy savings, even when you include the financing cost. I think the important part about this is to realize that energy is fundamentally different from the usual way we use credit scores. And that's why this is so important. A credit check on someone is great if they're taking out a loan to buy a car, because we know they're going to need to make payments, and cars don't make them any money. They cost a lot of money. A credit score is a lousy way to screen people for stuff that makes money. Solar energy saves people money on their bill. Energy efficiency reduces their energy bill. And so a tool like on-bill repayment that doesn't use a credit score but uses a much more benign metric like do you pay your utility bill on time is a great way to vastly broaden the number of people that can participate in energy efficiency and renewable energy and without substantially affecting the amount of people that default on their payments. One of the things that's really important about this is that there are lots of utilities already in this game. Electric cooperatives in particular have offered programs in many different states. We actually did a podcast with one called Midwest Energy based in Kansas, and they're allowing almost all of their customers to get this financing opportunity for insulation, energy efficient furnaces, water heaters, even on-site solar. And the benefit, of course, is that it means that the opportunities that we have in this new distributed era are available to everybody. So the question is, how do we change the rules? We know that we don't have the right rules for the system. We know that the incumbent players are not the best ones to deliver on the innovation and opportunity that we have, nor are they the ones that we want to benefit. The good news is that 25% of electric customers already have a say in what their utility does. They are either served by a municipal utility that is owned by their city, or they are a member owner of a rural electric cooperative. Many people, especially in the instances of the cooperatives, may not even realize that they are a member owner. We've done some interesting research, that's a little bit of an aside, that only about 10% of members turn out in cooperative board elections, which means that probably out of the 90% that don't, a good half of them have no idea that they even get a vote. One of the things that's remarkable about this, though, is that some of these locally controlled utilities are doing some of the most innovative things in this era. Farmers Electric Cooperative, for example, a very small cooperative, has about 650 customers based in Iowa, is one of the leading utilities in the entire country in the amount of solar they have per customer. And much of that solar is member-owned. They have not been held back by a traditional method of doing things, and they have been open to their members in figuring out ways to help them and to help the utility deliver cost-effective and renewable power. Georgetown, Texas, a municipal utility serving a town of about 100,000, signed contracts a couple of years ago, and starting next year, 100% of the electricity on an annual basis for that city will be served by wind and the sun. So there's an opportunity for 25% of customers out there to take advantage of the fact that they already have some say in their utility's behavior. So what about the 75% that don't? I love this magazine cover. If I was savvy enough, I'd figure out it's actually animated, but I can't figure out how to make it work when I'm doing a presentation, so I apologize. And it's pretty funny seeing Warren Buffett try to do this to Elon Musk. The whole point of this magazine cover was to illustrate, and I think perhaps one of the first times that a mainstream business magazine has picked up on this conflict, is the tension between the entrepreneurial and innovation and opportunity that we have in this system and the traditional monopoly utility companies. So changing these utilities isn't so straightforward. It's a big fight. As you can see here, Warren Buffett owns a lot of monopoly utility companies. In fact, that's really the secret of his financial success, is investing in monopoly industries and then raising prices. And Elon Musk, of course, started SolarCity, one of the first companies and now the largest company to offer solar as a service to make it easier for individuals to put solar on their home as long as they have a good credit score. And in this particular instance, NV Energy, which is owned by Warren Buffett, helped kill fair net metering compensation in Nevada. And it meant that Elon Musk's company, SolarCity, and a number of others simply had to exit the market because it was no longer cost effective. And as another illustration, APS and Tucson Electric Power, and I mentioned them before in terms of having a conservative nature, are also taking steps to protect their monopoly by reducing compensation their customers can have from installing solar energy. So what can we do about the incumbent monopolies who have a lot of political power? I actually saw, I think, once that the Florida utility, investor-owned utility companies collectively, but mostly Florida Power and Light, the largest one, have one lobbyist for every two legislators in the state legislature in Florida. So it's an uphill battle. But there are some exceptions. Hey, it is gonna animate. Fantastic. I'm just gonna stand here for a minute and appreciate this. Sorry. I don't remember what month it was, I apologize. It was in the last year. One exception to the rule of monopoly utility behavior is Green Mountain Power. And I think it's really important to talk about them because of how different they are than the traditional investor-owned utility company. So it's an investor-owned utility, which means it has to be responsive to shareholders, just like the other ones. Based in Vermont, it serves about 3/4 of Vermont customers. It's the only electric company in the entire country that has an alternative corporate structure called a benefit corporation, or a B corporation. And that alternative structure means that in addition to creating shareholder value, they are required to pursue greater social goods, as they put it, to become the Ben and Jerry's of the utility world. And unlike their peers, Green Mountain Power has done things like help customers finance energy efficiency and solar and energy storage, has developed local microgrids to deliver resilient power in many communities that were affected by Hurricane Sandy, and also published maps of their distribution grid to help their customers and other businesses identify the best places to add new local power generation. So we have an opportunity here. We have had a regulatory compact for about 100 years that suggests that investor-owned utility companies can serve the public interest, and as a result, we will shield them from competition. And we could change that and say to them that if we want to continue to retain that monopoly, that you have to restructure as a benefit corporation to more clearly serve the public interest because of the many, many, many instances in which they have used their power and influence to oppose the public interest. I'm at least not aware of a renewable portfolio standard that passed unanimously through a state legislature, and I'm willing to bet there aren't many out there that I haven't heard of. A second way that we can do this and address this issue of change for investor-owned utility companies is to figure out new rules that we can have for the system. This is an image from New York. They're doing a process called Reforming the Energy Vision. It's led from the top down through the regulatory system, so I'm not going to pretend that it's something that's going to happen everywhere or in Wisconsin in the near future. Sorry. But what they're doing is essentially implementing that concept that I mentioned earlier about the grid as a commons, that they're going to have utility companies and third parties and residential and business customers all having access to providing services on the energy grid. It's really a fundamental rewrite of the rules to supplant centralized control with distributed power. Utilities are still going to play a role. Somebody still has to maintain the poles and wires that are delivering energy to the homes and businesses. But it is going to fundamentally change the way that utilities play in that system. And I think even more importantly, it's going to fundamentally change utilities as in terms of removing them as the reliable oppositional force, all things good and all change on the electric system. Ultimately, there unfortunately is no one-size-fits-all set of rules for a 21st century electric grid. But there is, I think, one universal principle, which is that if the technology and the economics of last century's utility monopoly are obsolete, then it is time to adopt rules that enable the transition from energy monopoly to energy democracy. Thank you.